So we have in our extended family a relative who owns a very popular restaurant on Vancouver Island, and we've eaten at this establishment a number of times, and its popularity, in my opinion anyway, is absolutely deserved. The service is professional, the servers are very warm, the ambiance of the restaurants was good, but of course, most importantly, the food is consistently fine. I also have a hunch that if you go there often enough, you'll be likely to see some famous folk amongst the regular schlubs like me. In fact, a reliable source informs me that they recently had some famous former royals sit down for dinner the other day. Though I know the term former is now in some dispute. I'm not sure where that one's going, but they'll work it out. And yes, former royal sightings are now a thing here on Vancouver Island. They have begun eclipsing the popularity of the Brandt Festival. I think perhaps they might even do the same to Show and Shine, but I guess we'll see. I found myself this week trying to imagine being the famous pair's server in that particular eatery. And somehow, you know, good evening, I'm Gladys, and welcome to the restaurant. Let me tell you about tonight's specials, or I'm sorry, we're out of the salmon, or fries or salad, or would you like to split the check with your bodyguard? Somehow all the normal restaurant things don't kind of sound enough, right? Furthermore, I had the feeling that if I was ever their server, I'd probably give the guests the impression that I was speaking in tongues. And I say that because I've had a few encounters with celebrities over the years, especially when I was working in busy emergency departments. And for some reason, I found that my ability to speak rationally and intelligibly becomes rather limited when I'm faced with fame. There's something about being face-to-face with a Hollywood legend or, on occasion, a political figure that I respected that makes me want to ramble on, makes me want to blither in a voice that is similar in pitch and timbre to Mickey Mouse. So I find myself that, you know. I regularly think about the former and late minister emeritus of this congregation, the Reverend Roy Rogers, who had an especially close-up royal sighting, having the distinct honor of having Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip in the congregation one Sunday morning when he was ministering in Powell River. And I asked him about it, and he told me that they were both lovely and gracious, but I neglected to ask him what he preached on. I mean, I have trouble imagining even choosing a text for that occasion, never mind preaching coherently. And sure enough, with my luck, the psalm reading for that week would be, "Do not put your trust in princes." And I would choose it, you know. Anyway, that brings me to something I know I've repeated to you over the years that I've had the pleasure of serving here. There are some vexing issues that I struggle with in the faith, and they're often related to suffering. Illnesses, death of children, suicide, the seeming lottery of birth families and location of where we happen to have been born, and random accidents. I mean, how do you make sense of those kinds of things? I've got questions. And I know that I've said to you on previous occasions that I'm looking forward to having a conversation with God about some of those things one day. And maybe that will happen. I don't really know how it works, to be honest, but I look forward to having God explain it to me. Maybe those questions will no longer be important. Perhaps I'll just somehow know, or maybe God will say, "Okay, Phil, here's how it all worked," and God will haul out some sort of schematic diagram, and I'll say, "That's brilliant, now I see," or maybe not, I don't know. But see, I have the hunch that it's rather more likely that I would just collapse in front of God. I mean, I'm the guy who found his tongue to be too large for his mouth when he found himself face to face with Katharine Hepburn one evening. Katharine Hepburn. And yet I think I'm the one who's going to be quizzing God about what's fair. And really, I'm just not so sure that finding myself being face to face with God will see me asking the tough questions. At best, I'll probably be unable to speak, and I'm more likely going to be on my face. Which, of course, brings me to our day of the year. It's Transfiguration Sunday. We've come to the end of the season of Epiphany, and we're next week on Ash Wednesday stepping into Lent and beginning the journey to that hillside outside of Jerusalem. And that's not necessarily a comfortable journey. As big and critical and cosmic concerns are worked out on Good Friday. Lent is in part about asking difficult questions, and not so much of God, but of ourselves. Of recognizing with honesty what's going on with us. But before we get there, and Wednesday will come soon enough, before we get there, we need to finish Epiphany. And in our part of the church, we do so by remembering the story of the Transfiguration, an event that is very much an epiphany, a revealing or a manifestation of the divine, serving as an important hinge point to move us from one seasonal theme to another seasonal theme. When Matthew tells the Transfiguration story, and the Gospel writers Mark and Luke also have versions of the same event as well, incidentally. But when Matthew begins it, he writes, 6 days later. And I wonder, okay, 6 days after what? If you're not simply reading a biblical book straight through, then lines like that are an invitation to look back, to make a connection, because more often than not, there is a connection, a link that will help us understand things just a little bit better. So when you take a look at the episode that Matthew relates to just before the Transfiguration, 6 days before, you'll see that it's the one where Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" You probably remember that one. And there are some interesting suggestions proffered, probably a bit of laughter at some of the identities that people were trying out for size. But eventually Peter powerfully recognizes Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And you may further remember that Jesus approves of that insight, and then he goes on to talk about his own death and resurrection, which of course causes Peter to rebuke him. And that in turn gets Jesus to give Peter something of a talking to. And there's, remember this? The dramatic, "Get behind me, Satan" line that's leveled at that particular disciple. And so then Jesus sits his stung followers down to try to get their heads around the notion that Jesus' people will need to deny themselves, and that following him requires them to take up their crosses. And that's an announcement you can guess that would cause some alarm to his hearers, because, well, what does that mean? It sure sounds sobering. Take up your cross. So, we've got that high, that moment of glorious recognition. Jesus, you're the Messiah. And then there's the serious news that discipleship, that following Jesus, comes at a cost. So we've got this kind of high and low. Well, the same thing happens in the Transfiguration story. The high in this case, however, isn't only emotional. It's also literal. And Jesus and a few of his disciples go up on a mountain. And trips up on mountains typically herald a confrontation or an expectation of some encounter with the divine throughout the biblical story. And Peter and James and John see Jesus transfigured, see him transformed. And he becomes dazzlingly bright as he converses with the two great figures of Israel's history with God, Moses and Elijah. And Peter, God bless him, says in awe at the sight of this, "We need to build memorials to the three of you." Now, I confess to having been a bit uncharitable to Peter in previous sermons about this somewhat strange response. But on further consideration, frankly, I'm impressed that Peter could even speak. I mean, hey, he's just seen something indescribable, something totally beyond our ken. And he responded in the best way he could, I suspect surely far better and far more competently than I would have. I think I'd be more of the... Then a voice says, just like it happened at Jesus' baptism, This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. And it seems that the voice now puts our three lads over the top, or more accurately, face down on the ground, because the sight and the sound of God, this glimpse of glory, is seemingly just too much and has made them afraid. The sight of God can do that to a fella, I guess. And Jesus has to reassure them. As they head down the mountain, another high to low scenario, Jesus tells them to keep this under their hats until he's been raised from the dead. And I have no doubt that James and John and Peter, who saw lots of amazing things, I'm pretty confident that they kept replaying this scene over in their minds, over and over and over in the years that followed. And that would be important in the days to come, particularly in the terrible time they would soon experience in Jerusalem. Even the agony of denying and betraying and witnessing Jesus' suffering and death, there would always be that memory that they'd had of a kind of a royal sighting. They'd had that glimpse of glory, and a little glory can sustain remarkably. Hence, Peter just hung on to this story, and he assuredly made sure that others heard it as well. I look back and I realize I've referenced 2 Peter a few times before in preaching. It's an interesting book of the Bible, but also it's a little tricky. It has some important stuff in its three brief chapters, a number of quotable passages, and its themes of being vigilant for false teachers and teachings, to keep growing in godliness and holding on tight to the promise of Jesus' return. Peter particularly addresses that in the second part of our reading today. Well, those are as timely today as they were when Peter first wrote them. Or was it Peter? Yeah, this is where it can get just a little bit tricky. Well, one of the interesting elements of 2 Peter, and this has been an issue since the very first days of the church, well, there's been uncertainty about its origins, about its author. Now, the church included it with the other works that we now call the New Testament, and they did that early on. But as best I can tell, it was never complete clarity that people had as to whether Peter himself wrote it, or whether some faithful disciples familiar to Peter and his teachings penned it some years later. So it may have been written in 65 AD, or may have been written the last of the New Testament documents. Maybe it was written in 165 AD. I don't really know. But this never reduced its authority in the church. That's pretty much always been recognized, and it's clearly had an application whether you lived in the first century, the second century, or the 21st century. It's had application because the Christian community, the church, has always experienced difficult times. It's known suffering, endured setbacks, struggled with opposition, known failure, experienced disappointment. Certainly true today. If you live in North Korea or Somalia or Nigeria or Iraq or Burkina Faso or a good many other places in this world, you know persecution, know some horrendously difficult times. But even if you live in a pretty safe locale like we do, there are times. There are times when you know you've done everything right. You've done everything by the book. You know, you've exercised four times a week. You've saved carefully, embraced the Canada Food Guide diet, made regular trips to the doctor, attended every single parent-teacher interview, kept your wine consumption under 3 glasses per week and made sure you had many more that number of glasses of water every day, taking the kids to church, kept a regular date night, drove the speed limit or according to road conditions, got 8 hours of sleep every night, attempted daily crosswords to keep your mind active, did unto others as you'd have them do unto you, and it still went horribly wrong. So what keeps you going in those times? Well, it often helps to remember. And if you don't personally remember, you hold on tight to the memories of others, our foreparents in the faith. Maybe it was Peter. Or maybe it was a disciple of Peter's whom he'd shared the story with. over and over and over till he knew they'd gotten it. And they'd shared it with the earliest church. I'm not sure it actually makes much difference on the ground. But they'd found themselves living in a community that was under pressure, living amongst a people who were having a really hard time, living amongst people who, perhaps out of ignorance or even with good intent, the road to hell being paved with such things. But somehow, some among them distorted the teachings they'd originally received and were turning the faith into something twisted and unfaithful to the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's pretty easy to get discouraged when things go sideways so horribly like that, especially when you're trying your level best to do things right. But instead of despairing, instead of giving up, they remembered. Sometimes in the midst of the storm, it's easy to forget. We forget where we began and how we got here in the first place. And that's why I keep coming back to our vision and mission statements. Yes, it's the third Sunday in a row that I've mentioned that. And you may recall that at the beginning of this year, I said I'd be doing this, nagging on some things I think are fundamental. So bear with me. But remember those things and a few other things. But remembering those things is critical in tough times. And I have a suspicion it's no less so in good times. Yes, the church was wisely reminded by Peter, or someone who knew his story really well, was reminded in a time of stress. You know, we're not making this stuff up when we talked about Jesus' return. No, we had a preview. We saw it with our very own eyes. We glimpsed glory. Jesus was brilliant with light from God the Father as the voice spoke. This is my son, marked by my love, focus of all my delight. So you mustn't forget this. We were on the holy mountain with him. We really were. And we heard a voice out of heaven with our very own ears. So look, here's my one point today. It's so, so important that we know our story. Especially in a time like ours where there are so many other stories that are competing for our hearts and minds. Everyone lives according to some story. It's just smart to know which story yours happens to be. Because it's possible to waste your life living into a false one. So for us, it's vital that we know the story of Christ. The Christian life isn't simply ethics and rules and commandments and Bible verses and having a loving disposition, as vitally as important as those things are. They're part of it for sure. But undergirding all of it is remembering our story, as much of it as we can. The singing we do, the prayers we make, the Bible readings, the preaching, the studies we continuously offer, they're really all about helping us to know and enter into the Christian story, so that we can choose life. The Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, the story of God's relationship with humanity through Israel. What comes after simply doesn't make much sense without it, so knowing it's really quite important. We hear that in our reading today. Peter's saying in the second half of our text this morning that Jesus is really a fulfillment of that part of the story. We're asked to remember that at a particular moment in history, God did something unique through this person named Jesus. We're to recollect and to remember that story, what he did, what he said, what happened. And when we do, sometimes we're given a little glimpse of glory, a glimpse of someone who will take your breath away. I dare say a legitimate royal sighting that might even render you speechless. If you're like me, it's not a one-off. You need to keep coming back to it, hearing and reading the story again and again and again, because I forget. And we're also well aware that knowledge of Jesus and the story won't magically make our problems evaporate. It will surely give us a place to stand when we deal with them. clarifying what the world tells us to be true, which is a bit different than what Jesus reveals to be true. So we remember Jesus and what God said about him. This is my son, the beloved. I delight in him. So you listen to him. Amen.